Cambridge Certificate of Proficiency in English 5 by University of Cambridge ESOL Examinations in conjunction with Cambridge University Press. This recording is copyright. CD 2 Cambridge Certificate of Proficiency in English Listening Test. Test 3
I'm going to give you the instructions for this test. I'll introduce each part of the test and give you time to look at the questions. At the start of each piece, you'll hear this sound. You'll hear each piece twice. Remember, while you're listening, write your answers on the question paper. You'll have 5 minutes at the end of the test to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. There'll now be a pause. Please ask any questions now, because you must not speak during the test. Now open your question paper and look at part one. You'll hear 4 different extracts. For questions 1 to 8, choose the answer, A, B or C, which fits best according to what you hear. There are 2 questions for each extract. Extract 1.
Two spacecraft were launched in 1977. On each is a golden disc containing information such that, should it ever fall into the tentacles of advanced spacefaring civilizations, they'll know something about us and the little rock we live on. On it can be found readings in many human languages and also music. It seemed appropriate to say something about who we are, what our feelings and aspirations are, and this is conveyed by no more satisfactory means than music. Is it possible that the soaring emotions which so many of the pieces represent will be entirely a mystery to them? Would they find it totally incomprehensible, strangely beautiful, immediately understandable? What other life forms make of these strange noises is anybody's guess. But in the meantime, the spacecraft are heading outwards, carrying out their number one function of sending back data about the nature of the space between the stars. The clock is ticking and their power source will not last forever. But even when their instruments are dead, they will continue to take our humanity into remote space for eternity in the hope that we're not alone. Two spacecraft were launched in 1977. On each is a golden disc containing information such that, should it ever fall into the tentacles of advanced spacefaring civilizations, they'll know something about us and the little rock we live on. On it can be found readings in many human languages and also music. It seemed appropriate to say something about who we are, what our feelings and aspirations are, and this is conveyed by no more satisfactory means than music. Is it possible that the soaring emotions which so many of the pieces represent will be entirely a mystery to them? Would they find it totally incomprehensible, strangely beautiful, immediately understandable? What other life forms make of these strange noises is anybody's guess. But in the meantime, the spacecraft are heading outwards, carrying out their number one function of sending back data about the nature of the space between the stars. The clock is ticking and their power source will not last forever. But even when their instruments are dead, they will continue to take our humanity into remote space for eternity in the hope that we're not alone.
Extract 2.
At the outset, I should point out 2 things about my recent research paper on the subject. Firstly, you will often find philosophical ideas applied to or tested by the concrete experience of individuals. For this, I make no apology. An idea has to bear the weight of concrete experience, or else it becomes a mere abstraction. Secondly, I've disguised individual identities rather more heavily than one would when reporting formal interviews. This has meant changing places and times, and occasionally compounding several voices into one, or splitting one voice into many. These disguises put demands on the reader's trust, but I am not, in any case, looking for the type of trust a novelist would seek to earn through a well-made narrative. That sort of coherence is lacking in real lives. My hope is that I have accurately reflected the sense of what I've heard, if not precisely its circumstances. At the outset, I should point out two things about my recent research paper on the subject. Firstly, you will often find philosophical ideas applied to, or tested by, the concrete experience of individuals. For this, I make no apology. An idea has to bear the weight of concrete experience, or else it becomes a mere abstraction. Secondly, I've disguised individual identities rather more heavily than one would when reporting formal interviews. This has meant changing places and times, and occasionally compounding several voices into one, or splitting one voice into many. These disguises put demands on the reader's trust, but I am not, in any case, looking for the type of trust a novelist would seek to earn through a well-made narrative. That sort of coherence is lacking in real lives. My hope is that I have accurately reflected the sense of what I've heard, if not precisely its circumstances.
Extract 3.
Technology must have offered enormous potential over the last decade in your work as a TV journalist, hasn't it?
We've got user-friendly videotape now, so you simply put in a cassette and film whatever you want. You come back, put it into another machine and edit.
So that means you must rush things just to get something out on air without having considered its true worth.
That issue comes up way before that, when you decide what to shoot and what to ignore. If you're lucky, you have the luxury of choice, but there are thin days with very little action.
But how do you know how what you film will fit into the news context of any given day?
You don't when you're out there on the street. You just have to go with your gut reactions. And it's surprising how much good news doesn't appeal to the eye.
The result must be disjointed in the context of the whole news programme that we, the public, later see.
That's the skill and experience of the editor, not to let you see the joins, or perhaps I should say the cracks.
Technology must have offered enormous potential over the last decade in your work as a TV journalist, hasn't it?
We've got user-friendly videotape now, so you simply put in a cassette and film whatever you want. You come back, put it into another machine and edit.
So that means you must rush things just to get something out on air without having considered its true worth.
That issue comes up way before that, when you decide what to shoot and what to ignore. If you're lucky, you have the luxury of choice, but there are thin days with very little action.
But how do you know how what you film will fit into the news context of any given day?
You don't when you're out there on the street. You just have to go with your gut reactions. And it's surprising how much good news doesn't appeal to the eye.
The result must be disjointed in the context of the whole news programme that we, the public, later see.
That's the skill and experience of the editor, not to let you see the joins, or perhaps I should say the cracks.
Extract 4.
One of the things I'm trying to do here is actually to unwrite my own writing, reimagine the writing, destroy it, rough it up. When we began editing the film, we assembled it in story and scene order, and that ran at about 4 hours, 35 minutes, which is a bit long for even the most generous audience. So, obviously, our aim is to try and bring the film down to a pleasurable length without damaging it. It's rather like when you're remodelling or renovating a house. Necessarily, in order to make sense of the film, we've had to smash through walls, we've had to rearrange the original architecture, and that makes an enormous mess. So what were sometimes quite elegant transitions, where the grammar of the film was perfectly easy to follow, all that's been destroyed by this process of how can we shorten this film sensibly. It's interesting work, but in the process there's dust everywhere, there are cracks, there's a lot of residual destructive elements to be tidied up. We're still reducing the film, but now we can plan the decorating. One of the things I'm trying to do here is actually to unwrite my own writing, reimagine the writing, destroy it, rough it up. When we began editing the film, we assembled it in story and scene order, and that ran at about 4 hours, 35 minutes, which is a bit long for even the most generous audience. So, obviously, our aim is to try and bring the film down to a pleasurable length without damaging it. It's rather like when you're remodelling or renovating a house. Necessarily, in order to make sense of the film, we've had to smash through walls, we've had to rearrange the original architecture, and that makes an enormous mess. So what were sometimes quite elegant transitions, where the grammar of the film was perfectly easy to follow, all that's been destroyed by this process of how can we shorten this film sensibly. It's interesting work, but in the process there's dust everywhere, there are cracks, there's a lot of residual destructive elements to be tidied up. We're still reducing the film, but now we can plan the decorating.
That's the end of part 1.